everybody. Thank you for being here. Oh well, continuing to explore these old Zen stories. Zen's famous for our stories, so I don't know why. Some of them are great, some of them are a little bit strange. So this is the eighth story in the Mumonkan Koan collection. And this time I'm using Nyogen Sensaki's translation. I like that a little better than Robert Aiken's. Yueyan said to his students, Zishong, the first wheel maker in China, made two wheels of 50 spokes each. Now suppose you remove the hub uniting the spokes. What would become of the wheel? If Zishong had done this, could he still be called a master wheel maker? So Yueyan is a teacher talking about an ancient figure named Zishong. Here it is again. Yueyan said to his students, Zishong, the first great wheel maker in China, made two wheels of 50 spokes each. Now suppose you remove the hub, uniting the spokes, what would become of the wheel? If Zishong had done this, could he still be called a master wheel maker? So it turns out in Chinese mythology, Chinese stories, Zishong is the one who invented the wheel. So they know who invented the wheel in China. I suppose if any culture is going to take credit for the inventing the wheel, the Chinese probably can make a pretty good case. So right away, this story is invoking deep history, invoking authority, invoking the ultimate. Zishong's wheels are the original wheels, you know, the first wheels, the true wheels. So this represents the nature of wheelness, if you will. So right away we should be wondering, like, what is this deep question about the true nature of wheels? And so the teacher with his students asked them about the way we think about things, about the way we make concepts of things. What if you took the hub out? What if you took a hub out? Is it still a wheel? And if Zishong, this ancient figure, was a master wheel maker and his wheels don't have hubs, is he still a wheel maker? And so we can all picture this, and I think at this point we would say, no question, well, that's a wheel without a hub. Sure, it's a wheel. Anybody can see that. But then what if we took away the spokes or took away the rim? Then maybe you'd say, oh, that's a rim or that's a pile of spokes. Or maybe you aren't quite sure. It's a pile of sort of straight little wood or metal rods. Could be anything. Is that a rim of a wheel or a hoop for a barrel or some kind of art piece, some kind of junk? At some point, we don't know it's a wheel anymore. And of course, this is all common sense, so why waste your time on this? There's more important things probably to talk about. But it is worth thinking about, I think. The way we make things into things. And this is one of the themes of our teachings on emptiness, which are hard to understand. Because the mechanism we have for understanding things is a little bit undercut by emptiness. We like common sense. We say that's common sense. And if it's common sense, it must be true. But these teachings suggest that although common sense is good as far as it goes, common sense is like a helpful kind of shortcut when we try to understand what's happening with us, with each other, with our world. Wheels are just an example. Common sense can also blind us. Common sense can also confuse us. Common sense can cause us to miss it in fundamental ways. So the idea is to really notice the way we use concepts, and we do this without thinking about it, or maybe nothing but thinking about it. The way we use concepts to define things and separate things and to sort of validate and make sense of our world, and we use them very quickly. The brain is very fast, 100 or is it 1,000 billion neurons, lots of neurons, working overtime all the time. When they're first doing, I read that when they're first doing real-time brain research, and they put people in the brain scanner, they would be like, why is there all that activity? We haven't asked the guy to do anything. So they just ignore that data, you know. Later they figure out, well, actually there's things happening all the time that matter in the brain. And this is part of what's happening. The brain is conceptualizing. Making sense of things, separating things. But the thing about it is that as soon as we separate something, we miss something too. We stop at a surface, we stop at an edge, we stop at a label, we stop at an idea. And the problem with that is it leads to really kind of rigid ways of thinking. Sort of rigid views about who and what we are and what's happening around us. There's a great line in the Metta Sutta, you know this line? The wise are going to be better off by not having fixed views. So this is a great thing to think about. Our fixed views. Can we be wiser about that? But the idea is not just like you should be more broad-minded or more curious, which is a good thing, but there's a more fundamental question here. To notice the way you create views and hold on to views. And so these thought exercises, like with Zishang's wheel, with the hub removed, sound silly in a way, but actually they're digging into some deep waters. Some things we do so automatically we don't see them. So we need these strange devices of weird stories and taking hubs out of wheels. If it can't really spin anymore, is it a wheel? And it's interesting to just kind of notice, you know, with everything we conceptualize, like, how does it work for us? What's the exact moment where it goes from being a wheel to a collection of wheel parts? When's the exact moment that you take away enough parts that you can't even tell they're wheel parts? They're just parts, just things, just something we see. And at some point, does the something drop away too, and we're just seeing shape and color? No need to add a concept. And at what point does the idea of shape and color, which is also an idea that we map onto reality, if there is such a thing, when does that drop away? And there's just some sense of a seer who's seeing, a seer who's experiencing, an experiencer who's noticing something. And at what point does even that feeling, the feeling of being an experiencer, being a seer, drop away? And there's just the seeing, just this moment. And so meditation practice is wonderful because it can help us to recognize this vast array of things that's happening every moment. And then we can go about it differently. We can feel it and see it and understand it differently. And that may really help us and help our world. So the idea with teachings or wisdom is not just to get a better idea, but to understand something of the nature of making ideas and the ways that they're right and the ways that they're wrong inherently. Never right and never quite wrong. So you might think that the point of Zazen, our meditation, you know, something about following the breath, probably Scott said in the library, something like that. You say something like that, follow the breath. And if your thoughts, if you get lost in your thoughts, come back to the breath, right? Sounds like sort of a little project, might calm you down, that'd be good. Feel a little better, that'd be nice. Might help your immune system or something, calmer. So you might think it's all project to get good at letting go of your thinking and just breathing. And maybe one day, if you do this right, thinking will just sort of stop bothering you so much and you can just breathe. Maybe somebody will be really impressed by you if you could do that or something. Well, that can happen. This thinking can stop. There's a lot of it, but it pauses from time to time. Sometimes the thinking pauses and you don't even notice the thinking is paused, because who's the one doing the noticing? The thinker, right? So how's that person going to notice? You know? But actually, getting good at thinking or not thinking or not breathing is not the point of Zazen, actually. The point of Zazen has something more to do with developing a feeling, an appreciation, a sense, an understanding of just the flow of all of this. Thoughts are thoughts, concepts are concepts, flowing and coalescing and changing moment to moment to moment. Sometimes we believe them, sometimes we see through them in a certain way. Sometimes we're brilliant, sometimes we're confused, but really it's just the coming together of so many things, moment by moment. We're involved, but we are far from in charge. Have you noticed that? So the classic way of speaking about emptiness is that all dharmas, meaning all things, are empty of something. So you can't have emptiness without empty of something. And the idea is that we don't realize what we're doing. And what we're doing is we're pouring into everything we receive. We're pouring something in there. We perceive it and instantly and automatically kind of pour this magical kind of goo in there, which leads the thing we're perceiving to seem separate and solid and like a sort of quality to it, a sort of an isness to it. So we pour this sort of, I'm making this real through my perception stuff into our conceptions. And it appears to be a certain way. So the stuff that we pour into our conceptions, the Buddhist sages had a word for it, you know. That's interesting, too, to think about what we have words for. We don't have words for this stuff, you know, because we don't know it very well. Anyway, they had a word for this process. The thing that we pour in is called self-nature, svabhava in Sanskrit. Sort of belief or understanding that things are separate, things are stable, things are sort of permanent, at least for a while. I mean, we kind of all believe in impermanence, right? You know, none of us here believes completely in permanence, right? That would be stupid. But our way of believing in impermanence is not really impermanence, actually, is it? It's like temporary permanence. We would like a car to be permanent for at least about 12 years, right? And then it can stop working. You know, that'd be okay, right? But we want permanence till then. And we want permanence for ourselves. 80 years maybe, you know? As long as our health's good, you know? And we would like that. A little more than 80 is okay, too. Is Edie still here? No. I didn't mean to kind of cut her off there. Shoot. Take it back. But, you know, of course we don't know, you know? So it's beautiful to get to bow at the altar up here, and I hope, and you can come bow at the altar, you know, yourself too, not in the middle of formal practice, but, you know, when you're here before or after on your own. You should definitely come bow to the altar. And what's wonderful right now is when you bow to the altar, there's a picture of Nancy there, especially if you knew Nancy. And even if you didn't, it's beautiful to bow with an image of somebody on the altar. So, you know, when somebody dies, it's so clear, right? Our incredible sort of resistance to impermanence can do nothing but melt away, and it's difficult for us because we've been pouring this self-nature into everything, trying to make things stick around, make things be what we think they are. And so these teachings are not saying it isn't what you think it is exactly. There is someone named Nancy. There is, lectern. There is a car that we hope will start when we go back to our car. So it's not that these things aren't. These teachings suggest that we just get a lot more curious, though. You know, X really is X and Y really is Y, or is it? Maybe X just appears to be X. It's not that it's not X, but it's not really X in the way that we think it is. Or maybe it's only X. Its X-ness is kind of a manifestation, a coming together, you know? A coalescence that's just on like an instant, and then something else happens. So it's not X and it's not not X. You have to talk like that, you know. You're trying to talk about this stuff. Maybe it's better not to talk about it. The point being, if we pay attention, we start to see. Take some time. That things are more fluid and dynamic and not what we thought they were than we can ever quite imagine. And this can be sometimes surprising and frightening, but it can also be wonderful. It can also be liberating. Because we too are that way, and so you can set down this burden of having to be yourself all the time. That's like our biggest job in the world, right? Hard work every day. Like, oh, I gotta be myself. Gotta keep this together, you know? What if the others find out I'm no good? I gotta keep it up, you know? So it's hard work. And so that's kind of the liberative quality of emptiness, is we can soften. Because I'm not this self exactly anyway. I'm just some strange coming together in this moment. You know, we had some pictures out because we were looking through old pictures, looking for what pictures we had of Nancy for the memorial. And yeah, so seeing pictures of myself at 22, and then the same next album over had a picture of me at 10 years old. Is that the same person? I mean, I put the same label on it. I say, Tim. Look, there's Tim. Doesn't look the same, you know? Doesn't feel the same. Of course, it's just an image on a picture now. Did that person ever exist? So it's true, everything, and with everything we see and hear or feel. Like the other day at the annual meeting, I showed some pictures of when we were building out this room. When we first got here, it was just an empty shell, plywood, mix of plywood and concrete floor. The concrete was about a half inch too high, so that was a problem. And just like no lights, no heat, nothing, you know, it was just a shell. And we audaciously, because we were 20-somethings then, just said, we can deal with this, we know what to do. You know, and set about, or maybe we were in our 30s by then. It was the other pictures were in our 20s. But anyway, those of us who were here then look at this room and we see it differently, you know. I can't help but not see Jeff McKenna laying floor over there and Bob laying out that wall and talking to me about his plans, and yeah, Bob and Lou Hinckley having kind of ridiculous repartee back and forth for hours and hours and hours. So everything is colored by everything, you know. So I'm not seeing the same room that anyone else is seeing. We have this idea of an objective reality. We think it's the same room, but it's not the same room. And then just for having seen those pictures, if we were there Saturday last, maybe you see this room a little differently too. But in a different way than I see it. And now if you're just hearing this from me now, and you're like, wait, am I seeing it the right way? There's no right way. So is there exactly a room here? It's just our view, it's just our image, it's just our conception. So this is all a little abstract, and I'm trying to be amusing about it, so that you'll keep listening, you know. I have to protect myself as somebody who's teaching something. But I really want to encourage us to think about these things and notice about these things, not just think about them. Am I holding a view here? Am I mapping something on something or someone? Including myself? Am I through a fixed habitual conception trying to make myself into something? And how's that feel? Often as not, it feels bad. It creates suffering to try to impose our view on others and on ourselves. It doesn't give us room to function. It doesn't give us room to be totally and fully alive. It doesn't give us space. So, you know, the old-fashioned kind of wooden wagon wheel, there's a hole in the middle of the hub, right, that the axle goes through, and then these little pegs or something to keep the wheel in one place on the axle so the wheel can turn around the axle. So isn't that funny to think about, that the way the hub works is the space in the middle. It's the space in the middle that allows the hub to work. So it's that way for us, too. It's the space in us that allows us to function. And we're so busily pouring in this sticky svabhava goop into ourselves and everything, there's no space left, you know? And it's painful. Somehow we can function really like top performance nonetheless, but it's a painful kind of functioning, even if we're not aware of the pain. So Nyogen Senzaki said this story about wheels is also a reference to a chapter of the Tao Te Ching. So it was really fun to get out the Tao Te Ching, which I've neglected for many years, and read chapter 11. Chapter 11, according to Red Pine's translation. There's apparently like 500 or something English translations of the Tao Te Ching. And in the Red Pine's introduction, he said his Chinese teacher told him, once you feel a need to translate the Tao Te Ching, you're done. That's like time to retire. It's like, somehow they talk about it like that. So anyway. Seems like a good translation, and he didn't retire, so that's good. So, chapter 11. 30 spokes converge on a hub, but it's the emptiness that makes the wheel work. Pots are fashioned from clay, but it's the hollow that makes the pot work. Windows and doors are carved for a house, but it's the spaces that make the house work. Existence makes something useful, but non-existence makes it work. Isn't that beautiful? 30 spokes converge in a hub, but it's the emptiness that makes the wheel work. Pots are fashioned from clay, but it's the hollow that makes the pot work. Windows and doors are carved for a house, but it's the spaces that make the house work. Existence makes something useful, but non-existence makes it work. And so it's the same with life and death too, isn't it? I was trying to say the other day about a little snippet about the history of Nancy and the Sangha, and that part of what ended up making it work was, you know, the last years that she actually wasn't here with her body. But actually she was making space, you know. She was helping to make it work. And I don't know if I understood that at the time, but that's how I feel now. Of course I'd love for you all to be here, but even when you're not here, you know, you're helping to make it work. That's how it works to be a Shuso, by the way. Carol's here visiting from Berkeley, about to be Shuso. Scott was just Shuso. And actually, really truly, the way I think about Shuso, before I even studied the story, the way I think about Shuso is that Shuso is like the hub of a wheel. And when someone first asked to be Shuso, Shuso is the head student, like they have to be a leader in the Sangha for a couple weeks or months, and they're new to that. And although some of them want to be Shuso before it happens, and some of them don't want to be Shuso, but which doesn't really matter, because once then they finally get to be Shuso, every single one of them is terrified. You know, what have I done? And it's because you think to yourself, oh my gosh, I'm the hub. It all hangs off me now. And I'm going to be like so central and, you know, under the bright lights, and everyone's going to be paying attention to me. Oh no, you know, I can't do that. And you can think about another version of this in your life where you have to be the central piece, like horrifying. But then you realize the hub doesn't make the wheel turn around. The wheel turns itself around. You just have to have the space in the middle, you know? You just have to allow. You just have to let the connections happen, let the spokes, you know, hook into you. Maybe like Jeff McKenna at the Sundance, you know? Maybe that's not a good analogy. That's a little more intense than being Shuso, I think. But anyway, we don't have to make it all happen. How could we make it all happen anyway? What a silly myth we put in our heads, you know? So that's one of those rigid, svabhava-filled ideas that I have to make it happen. I can't make it happen. We can only make it happen together. That's the only way. So it's good to remember that non-existence is important. And our basic stance is a stance of existence. So of course non-existence is disturbing, sometimes frightening, horrifying. We don't like people to be gone. This is natural and beautiful in its way. It's because we love each other that we don't want us to be gone. But when we're gone, we're not here to push the wheel around, maybe. But when we're gone, we're still the space in the hub. We're still allowing the Dharma wheel, the life wheel, the wheel that's bigger than any of our ideas, any of our conceptions. We're allowing that to turn. And we can only do that together. And we can only do that out of love. And the love is present even when we're pissed off at each other or confused or tired or don't want it to be the way it is. It's still there because that's the quality of the space. So emptiness sounds kind of cold when you hear about it. They use that English word emptiness. They had to pick some kind of English word for this concept. And emptiness sounds cold, but actually it's not cold. So for once in my career, I ended before the end. Anyone have any thoughts or anything they'd like to voice? Any empty words? The good thing about emptiness, too, is you can, like, it's freedom from performance anxiety, right? Because you can't say it right, you know? Right? You know? Since you can't say it right, you can't say it wrong. So you can just say it. What do you say?
Here's to emptiness.
Yay. I think we're going to read a Thich Nhat Hanh book in the Heart Sutra class, and I think he has a little line like that in there. Hurrah for emptiness. Yay, emptiness. But really, the hurrah also has to be a hurrah with tears too, right? So it's both. Yeah. Sometimes quiet words are the best. Thank you for those too. Mm.